Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Ollie Focus Pops or Ollie Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
I'm Shannon Bream.
I'm Bill Hemmer.
I'm Kennedy, and this is the Fox News Rundown.
Wednesday, February 22nd, 2023. I'm Jessica Rosenthal. Recent studies and standardized test scores have some warning about the effects of pandemic-related learning loss. And while some school districts are taking it seriously, the long-term impacts may hurt our economy.
From what I've seen, school districts are dramatically underestimating what it's going to take to allow students to catch up.
I'm Dave Anthony. It's Ash Wednesday.
The most visited day of the year for Christians visiting churches. And why is that? We receive a very visible symbol of our identity and of our belief.
And I'm Dr. Ben Carson. I've got the final word on the Fox News Rundown.
Last fall, we got the nation's report card on standardized test scores from across the country, and they were, in a word, disappointing. Fourth and eighth grade scores dropped, especially when it came to math.
We've never seen this magnitude of a drop, particularly in eighth grade mathematics. It is jarring. It is sobering. It is deeply disturbing.
Roberto Rodriguez is an assistant secretary at the Department of Education, and he participated in a National Assessment of Educational Progress roundtable late last year. Now we have a new study, one that assessed learning loss in 15 countries. It concluded students on average lost about a third of a year of instruction. A recent U.S.-based study released by the Education Recovery Scorecard found third through eighth graders in the U.S. lost more like half a year of learning. Rodriguez says there are ways to work on this. They've doled out billions to each state in American Rescue Plan Elementary and Secondary School Emergency Relief Funds. But now the burden is on school boards, superintendents, principals, and teachers to implement a plan and recover from the education losses.
So the latest study that I read was out of Education Week, and I believe I read that last week, that said, as a general approximation, we're looking at one third of a school year lost to our students from the pandemic year and moving forward.
Beth Kreider is the Peoria County Regional Superintendent in Illinois, overseeing 18 school districts.
But it's more than just the academic loss, right? It's attendance. It's the social emotional learning and the mental health struggles that we're seeing. All of that combined is that we have a lot of work to do in the public school system to recover and move forward post-pandemic. So we have some strategies that we're putting in place, and the evidence is suggesting that we need accelerated after-school programming. We need accelerated summer school programming, and then we need to wrap all of that in mental health supports. And so there's a lot that we can do to mitigate some of that learning loss and then accelerate the learning.
Is that something that you can mandate, or is that something that you just say, hey, parents, if you do want your kids to, you know, brush up, let's do, you know, enroll them in summer school? Or how do you sort of implement this in terms of either mandating it or just saying we're offering it?
That's a yes and. So you can mandate it for some learning loss for kids, absolutely. But as school districts, if we want to get into some of that funding, the ESSER funding, the COVID funding, if you will, we were required to write for after school programming and summer school programming into those dollars, or we did not receive them. So that's a major carrot for your school districts to go after those dollars and bring them to their local school districts, is to have those things available for their families.
Yeah, we keep hearing the money's available. There's some of the extra American Rescue Plan money left over. And you're saying if you want some of that, you have to account for it. You have to ask for it and have it doled out to you. And you have to prove that you need it and you have to have a business plan, essentially.
Absolutely. I run the alternative high school here for Peoria County for kids that haven't been successful in their home high school. And when I wrote for those dollars, it was very specific by percentiles of how much money had to go to those things. So it is written into the plan.
Wow. So finally, then, it sounds like you guys have a plan that you want to have implemented. What then would you tell parents who maybe don't necessarily see this as a big deal or aren't recognizing, you know, learning loss in their homes, especially those families that maybe don't have money for private tutors. I mean, what would you tell parents to do if they want to help their kids with this learning loss and reinforce that it's real and it's happening and it's harmful?
Well, let's start with the sense of urgency, and it's around developmental milestones. Kids are naturally supposed to go through certain things in middle school, high school, right? So what we're seeing, what teachers are reporting, is that a ninth grader is showing up more like a seventh grader developmentally. The sense of urgency is there. We have kindergartners that are showing up that maybe have not been around their peers of any age because they were in their homes for so long. So there are those developmental milestones kids need to be hitting, and they need to be in social situations. They need to be back in school full time, and they need to be getting those supports, because without them, those delays are going to continue, and we will see those delays continuing throughout their lifespan unless we get a hold of those now. And early intervention is always best.
It turns out not all learning loss is equal. Thomas Kane, the faculty director of the Center for Education Policy Research at Harvard, has been studying the COVID-related school interruptions and found that students from lower-income homes have struggled more, finding the quarter of schools with highest shares of students receiving federal lunch subsidies missed two-thirds of a year of math learning, while the quarter of schools with the fewest low-income students lost just two-fifths of a year.
It's likely to have been due to a number of different factors. Number one, higher-income parents were more likely to be in jobs that allowed them to work from home, and as a result, parents were more available for, you know, monitoring students learning online. Another factor is likely to have been, you know, broadband access. Another would simply be access to a quiet space at home, like having your own bedroom to be able to do your lessons, or a desk where you could sit at to do your lessons rather than being gathered around a kitchen table with your brothers and sisters all trying to do lessons online at the same time. I think there were a number of different factors that likely played a role.
What should we do then right now? If learning loss is real and damaging, then how do we fix this? Because you can't just keep, you know, a bunch of 6 to 16-year-olds in school for longer days. I mean, they're, you know, your brain can't absorb everything all at once. This would obviously have to happen over time, this whole catch-up process, right? So what do we do?
So, Jessica, that is a terrific question. And so, first of all, your listeners should know that these declines in achievement mean students have lost a lot. Like, so we've looked in the past at what happened in states that saw big increases in achievement. And when achievement was increasing, we saw that earnings were rising, college going rose, arrest rates declined. And now that we've seen achievement fall, based on that history, we predict there's going to be about a 1.6% decline in students' lifetime earnings. Now, 1.6% doesn't sound like a gigantic loss, but it's about $20,000 per student over the course of their lifetime. Now, from what I've seen, school districts are dramatically underestimating what it's going to take to allow students to catch up. So just for, you know, your listeners, I've looked at the research on the effects of things like summer learning, the effects of tutors, double dose math. So you're right, it's hard to dramatically lengthen the school day, but there has been research on the effects of providing students with an extra period of math or an extra period of reading. So here would be the kind of program that would be necessary to help students catch up. So provide high dosage tutors to 10% of students, where high dosage tutoring means a student is getting a tutor for three times a week for the whole school year. Many districts are rolling out providing tutors, but not nearly as high dosage as three times per week for the whole school year. But suppose we could do that for 10% of students. Suppose we did summer school and we got 75% of students to show up for summer school. Suppose that we provided an extra period of math instruction to 30% of students. And suppose on top of all that, we extended the school year by 2.5 weeks. No district is doing anything like that. And yet, if you added up the effect sizes for all of those interventions, it would add up to about a half a year's worth of growth. And a lot of districts have lost more like a whole year or a year and a half. So school districts need to be doing much more. And the reason why I mention that is districts are sitting on about $190 billion in federal aid that they received since the beginning of the pandemic. And those dollars need to be spent by September 24. And unless districts start to rethink how they're using that money and rethink their recovery plans, that money will have been spent and students will still not have caught up.
That's a really important point, that if you do have the dollars, because this, I was thinking as you were talking, this would take additional funding. And if you're saying the funding is largely there, that seems like that would be the most obvious way to put it to use. Let me ask you just briefly a couple more questions. One, this notion of dollar loss, I'm seeing this economist from the Hoover Institution. He looked at this data too, and he said he estimated $70,000 of loss in income for impacted kids over the course of their lives and $28 trillion in losses to the economy this century because of this learning loss. I don't know how we come up with these numbers at such an early stage and forecast that, but I think many would see that. And I've spoken to a couple of people, just average people, about this topic, and they're very skeptical that we're already concluding fiscal loss due to learning loss.
So as I said, what we did was we looked back and saw, okay, so in the states that saw large increases in the National Assessment of Educational Progress during the 90s, what happened to the incomes of those people who graduated from school in those states? And there were huge increases in earnings. And so, like, just based on that historical fact, we're saying, okay, well, what's likely to happen from the declines? That other research that you're citing from Stanford, that's using a different set of data, but basically saying, okay, well, what do we know about the relationship between students' achievement on end of year test scores and earnings and college going later in life? And, you know, everybody has found over the last 40 years that we've been looking at this, a relationship between higher achievement on these tests and better labor market opportunities. So it stands to reason that if just given the relationships in the past, what would we expect from such a large decline?
Finally, I just want your thoughts, and this is sort of a broader topic, but it might be related. We hear a lot about how generally we're not educating our kids for the 21st century. You know, companies have long been complaining now for years about a skills gap, that people just aren't prepared for the jobs of today. How do we move through learning loss that's pandemic related and sort of reconcile that with the sense that even before the pandemic, kids were maybe not getting the education that we need for our economy?
So we had been making progress before the pandemic, although it was slower, I think, than most folks wanted. You know, the black-white achievement gap had been narrowing between 1990 through 2015. Average achievement in math, especially, and in early grades reading, had risen substantially. So we had been making progress, and we lost about 40% of that progress just in 3 years. At least 40% of the progress in eighth grade math we lost between 2019 and 2022. So yes, there were problems even as of 2019, but those problems just got a lot worse over the last few years.
Professor Tom Kane, faculty director at the Center for Education Policy Research at Harvard, thank you for joining us.
All right. Thanks, Jessica.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network. Subscribe and listen to the Trey Gowdy Podcast. Former federal prosecutor and four-term U.S. congressman from South Carolina brings you a one-of-a-kind podcast. Subscribe and listen now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.
This is Dr. Ben Carson with your Fox News commentary coming up.
The party is over in Rio. Brazil's carnival has come to an end. Same thing for New Orleans. After all the parades and celebrations and bead tossing, leading up to Mardi Gras, or what's also called Fat Tuesday. And this year, revelers could enjoy that without COVID restrictions in New Orleans. The 2023 Rex, King of Carnival, is Tulane professor Ludovico Fioli.
I've come to understand the wonderful good fortune that being able to congregate with the community represents.
But all of that celebration is over. It's Ash Wednesday, a much more solemn day for Christians.
A beginning of Lent, a period of purification and preparation for the great celebration of Easter.
Jonathan Morris is a theologian and Fox News contributor, a former priest.
One of the days of the year where we see more religious attendance than any other day, including Easter, including Christmas.
Really?
It's Ash Wednesday.
Really? I would have thought Christmas Eve and Christmas Day would be number one.
By far, at least in the Catholic Church, as you mentioned, I was a Catholic priest for many years. So I saw many Ash Wednesday services in many parts of the country and around the world. The most visited day of the year for Christians visiting churches. And why is that? We receive a very visible symbol of our identity and of our belief. It's a way of saying, I want to be a part of something.
But why? What is the ash physically? What is the symbolism?
Sure. The ash is, think of ash as a symbol of death, back to the earth. Remember the story of Genesis and the creation of man and woman, man coming forth from the ground, and that we are temporal. We're going back to the ashes. We're going back to the earth. And that's, of course, a very, very vivid, but also a very, I would say, morbid in the healthiest of ways, a healthy reminder that I better get my life straight because time is short.
Okay, so why does it begin Lent? Why does that start the Lent season?
Well, it goes back to the example of Jesus who went out into the desert before he began his public ministry. And that's really what Lent is. It's a 40-plus days of purification in preparation for the beginning of our Christian journey.
The faithful are asked or expected to give something up for Lent, correct?
Yes. In different Christian traditions, there are different invitations of what we can do during Lent. Giving up something, doing something hard that purifies us, that reminds us that just giving in to every whim is not necessarily going to bring us to happiness. That's
okay.
One, right?
Okay.
Another one would be almsgiving. It's saying the things that I have, right, the things that I own, yes, they're objectively mine legally, but there's not absolute ownership in the Christian worldview.
Mm-hmm.
That I might have $100 in my pocket, but that $100 also is meant for the good of others.
Okay,
so there's almsgiving.
To donate.
Yes.
To give.
That's also convenient for churches, I think. So I'm not sure where the origin.
All right, that's fair.
Okay? But I think it is a healthy thing to give, right? And then third is prayer, right? To increase our prayer life, to connect with God, to converse with God, to deepen our relationship with Him through prayer.
But these days, fewer people are connecting with God in church. Back in 1972, 92% of Americans in a Pew Research survey identified as Christian. In 2020, that number's down to 64%. Nearly a third say they're religiously unaffiliated. The other 6% identify as Jewish, Muslim, Hindu, or Buddhist. Lifeway Research reports in 2019, 4,500 Protestant churches closed across America, a first in the years it's been tracking that, a trend believed to have accelerated during the COVID pandemic. And Lifeway also reports in 2017, it did a survey of 18 to 22-year-olds who had attended church regularly while in high school. 7 in 10 of them stopped going. But Jonathan Morris says that does not worry him.
God has not been diminished, even if our faith or our practice of religion has diminished. In other words, nothing really, really important has changed.
Okay.
God is still, in my belief, Christian belief, God is just as much God. He is just as much an all-loving, all-powerful, providential being as he was before the pandemic and 50 years ago and even in the kind of golden age of Christianity in America. We're not going to church because we don't believe as much. Our parents went to church because they had to go to church or they felt guilty if they didn't go to church. What's going to happen now? There will not be a major change in this shift, in my belief, until we suffer deeply as a country or individually.
So we have to have a calamity of some kind for people to turn more to God for answers?
Think about after 9/11, churches were filled. Think about major moments in our life. I prayed more deeply when I was going through moments of existential crisis than when things were going well. So when things go badly for us as a country during times of war, God forbid, during times of calamity, financial
or economic
right, crisis,
yeah, yeah.
God forbid, that's when people will start asking the big questions that our grandparents asked. There will be a great awakening. I think it will be instigated or generated by suffering.
One reason that people cite a lessening of faith, people think that the church, let's say Catholic Church, right, that it's not keeping up with modern times, the beliefs people have, whether it's abortion or marriage or contraception, that the church is behind, and people think that they just can't go to the church anymore, they don't trust it. Child sexual abuse scandal, the whole thing that's happened with over the last couple of decades. Do you think that the church needs to change?
The church doesn't need to adapt to modern times. In other words, change itself so that it's just like everything else. Just the opposite. We need to change with the times in order to keep up with God, in order to make sure that the teachings that we are transmitting are as Jesus would teach the people of our day. Jesus said, love others as I have loved you. That's the big challenge. How do we love other people as Jesus would love them?
A parent that is not bringing a child into churches or into faith as they grow up, are they robbing that child of something, or are they depriving the child of the opportunity for faith?
I remember when I was a priest down at Old St. Pat's Cathedral in the Soho section of New York City, which is a very hip area, a very young demographic. The average person in the neighborhood who lived there was probably about 25 years old. And many of them told me, I'm kind of ticked off at my parents. And I said, I thought, you know, maybe, I don't know, who knows why they were ticked off. And one after another told me, because they never gave me an opportunity to really know my faith and to come to a relationship with God. They did this not because they hated me, but because they wanted to allow me to choose. And I remember one saying to me, you know, what if they had done the same thing with math or science? Hey, listen, we don't want to brainwash you, so we're not going to give you any math lessons, any science lessons. We're going to let you discover it on your own. And in these cases of these young people, actually maybe the path that their parents chose actually worked for them. But my guess is that there are hundreds and thousands of others like them whose parents were saying the same things, either like philosophically, we don't want to brainwash you, or else just, and this is probably more likely, just a little bit lazy.
I always found it interesting with religion. It's where you were born and where you live in the world that decides how necessarily what faith you're exposed to when you grow up. In America, of course, most people would be the Christian faith if they're going to church, not Judaism or Buddhism or Hinduism. India would be different. You'd be different if you were in other parts of Asia. It would be different if you grew up in the Middle East. Kids don't say, okay, here are the five religions. What do you think fits you best?
Some people would use that as a reason why we shouldn't be Christian or whatever it is that we our parents were. We are responsible to God in as much as God reveals himself to us. Maybe it's a longing for understanding the life's big questions about eternity. But God is able to, because he's so much bigger than time or place or religion, that he can reveal himself in a way that then we have to respond. Or we can. We have an opportunity to respond to. So much different than, hey, listen, Catholicism or Christianity can't be true, because what about those who never even heard about Christianity because they were born Muslim? I would say the same thing. That Muslim, that Jew, that atheist, that God has not changed if we believe in God. God will reveal himself to us in ways that are inconceivable, and we're only responsible to that truth, that goodness, that beauty, in as much as it's been revealed to us.
But with all the religions, unless you're atheist, just about everybody believes there is some sort of a higher power, right? In that,
absolutely.
No matter which one religion you're following.
Yes, especially I would say, especially the monotheistic, the three great monotheistic religions that you spoke of: Islam, Judaism, Christianity. There are other kind of spiritual belief systems that don't believe in a personal God as we do. But yes, you're exactly right.
Jonathan Morris, theologian, Fox News contributor, former priest, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
In other news,
I'm Gianna Gelosi. If you have an old iPhone laying around, it could be worth some serious cash. A first-generation iPhone still in its factory-sealed box sold for an eye-popping $63,356.40 at an auction on Sunday. That's 10 times its original price of $599 back in 2007. At the time, the first-release smartphone featured an innovative touchscreen, a web browser, and a 2-megapixel camera and 8 gigs of storage. It received Time Magazine's Invention of the Year and quickly became Apple's best-selling product. Compare that to today's tech with the iPhone 14 Pro's 48-megapixel camera and anywhere from 128 gigs to a terabyte of storage. The seller of the auction phone, Karen Green, said she got the phone as a gift but never used it because she didn't want to switch wireless carriers. So it sat in its unopened box on her shelf for 12 years. But in October, Green said she saw an unopened first-release iPhone sold for more than $39,000 at an earlier auction. She said she's going to use the $63,000 she made to start a cosmetic tattoo studio in New Jersey. The buyer hasn't been revealed. For the Fox News Rundown, I'm Gianna Gelosi.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network, stay on top of the latest news and information from Fox News. Listen and download the Fox News Hourly Update on your time. The trending stories you need anytime you want it. Listen and download now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com. Rate and review the Fox News Rundown on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen.
It's time for your Fox News commentary.
Dr. Ben Carson.
What's on your mind?
As we celebrate Black History Month this February, Americans of all stripes would do well to remember that Black history is not something apart from American history, but simply another part of our great national story. Unfortunately, in years past, Black History Month has been used as a cudgel to divide the American people based on race. All the sins from America's past are highlighted. Radical anti-American figures are elevated. Extreme ideologies like critical race theory are pushed on our children. And some are even attempting to redefine the very date of America's founding. This year, I wanted to change the narrative by taking this opportunity to highlight just one lesser-known African-American hero from our history and share his story as an example of patriotism and unity. Peter Salem was born into slavery in Framingham, Massachusetts in 1750 and lived there until age 25 when he was emancipated so he could enlist as a Massachusetts Minuteman. As a soldier, Salem fought in the very first engagements of the Revolutionary War through his participation in the Battle of Lexington and Concord with Colonel John Nixon's 5th Massachusetts Regiment, which included several other African-American soldiers. Later that year, Salem fought in the Battle of Bunker Hill and was widely credited with firing the shot that killed British Major John Pitcairn, which gave the fledgling Continental Army a much-needed morale boost early in the war. Salem received an accommodation from the Massachusetts General Court for his bravery at Bunker Hill, and then continued his service by reenlisting with the 4th Continental Regiment. After the Revolutionary War, Salem built a home in Leicester, Massachusetts, and struggled to get by while working as a weaver, gardener, and chair repairman, struggling to earn a living. At the age of 66, Salem died in obscurity at a poorhouse back in Framingham. Salem, like Crispus Attucks, Phyllis Wheatley, Titus Colborne, and so many other Black patriots of the American Revolution, stood up for the cause of independence because they understood the very promise America represents. Though we failed to perfectly live up to those ideals at the time our nation was founded, today America remains the land of equality, liberty, and opportunity for all. Our past isn't perfect, but our story tells a tale of a people valiantly standing up for what they believe in. Our founding principles and the promises they hold have allowed each of us to grow up in a place where we are free to pursue our own American dream. As our past shows us, good men and women of every age need to defend these American values with courage and strength. Ronald Reagan reminded us that freedom is never more than one generation away from extinction, and it is up to all of us to keep the promise of America alive for our children, our children's children, and their children after that. Peter Salem answered that call, as did many others whose stories are known but to God. I think that's something worth reflecting on this Black History Month.
This is Dr. Ben Carson.
You've been listening to the Fox News Rundown. And now, stay up to date by subscribing to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com. Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts Plus on Apple Podcasts. And Prime members can listen to the show ad-free on Amazon Music. And for up-to-the-minute news, go to foxnews.com.
I'm Guy Benson. Join me weekdays at 3 p.m. Eastern as we break down the biggest stories of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers and guests. Listen live on the Fox News app or get the free podcast at GuyBensonShow.com.
Listen to the all-new Brett Baer podcast featuring Common Ground, in-depth talks with lawmakers from opposite sides of the aisle, along with all your Brett Baer favorites like his all-star panel and much more. Available now at FoxNewsPodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.